I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. If this is your first time hearing our show, I've got good news. It is based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today, and every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the people who listen. So we want you to be a part of the show with us, so please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. Today on the show, it is our annual Education Issues to Watch episode. It's a new year, and every day, the news is an endless fire hose of information. It is really hard to cut through that noise and feel like you know what's going on, even with issues that you care about. And over the past year, there have been countless huge stories and huge changes in the world of education. There's the Trump administration's attempt to dismantle the Department of Education. They've tried to make sweeping cuts and freeze funding some programs. And of course, issues like immigration enforcement affect kids in schools too. So on this episode, we're going to talk about some of the biggest education issues of the last year and explain what exactly happened and where they're at now. And that includes those examples I just gave. We'll also give you a few topics we think will start getting more and more attention in 2026. And I am joined on this adventure once again by Jason Klein. He's the Senior Director of Learning Partnerships at Northern Illinois University, and we started our conversation reflecting on the issues we thought would be a big deal last year and how they actually turned out. The first one that we cover, it's a big one: money and politics and their impact on schools. In so many ways, Jason, like, money and politics is everything, and everything is money and politics. But I went back and I listened to our conversation from last year to be like, okay, like, what exactly did we mean by that? And it felt like at least a large part of that conversation was about, like, local school board races, mm-hmm. the way that national politics can kind of trickle down and infiltrate cause conversations and arguments at the local level there. And I think that's interesting is that obviously that stuff didn't go away, right? Like, some of that stuff is still happening, obviously. But in some ways, it feels like it's been, I guess, I don't know, superseded by more of, when I hear money and politics in schools, it's more of, again, the kind of power and pressure from the federal government onto more state and local schools, and also even onto, like, individual students in certain cases here, right? So it's interesting the way that we framed it and the way that we were thinking about it last year, and the way that at least the perception of and the way that things have played out in the last year. So, but again, like, money and politics is kind of everything, and education just happens to also be, you know, involved with that too.
Yeah, education's on the front line yeah. of that money and politics. So I would say, thinking back about what we talked about with school board elections last year.
Yeah.
Last spring, as we were having this conversation, was a municipal election cycle with mm-hmm. local school board elections. And I will say, maybe my worst fears when we were having this conversation last year, thankfully, did not come to pass in
right.
in most communities. The school board elections felt pretty normal. Now, still on this trend of school board elections are more inherently political,
but not
than
quite
they
to
one
what
were.
It was in, like, 2022, when it was the, you know, it was school masking, it was book banning, it was all that it, stuff that was,
yeah,
also
probably
up.
It was. I would say it was no worse than that.
Okay, yeah.
So
fair enough. Yeah.
It may have been better in some places, may have been about the same in other places, but it wasn't worse. And I think my fear at this point last year was that it would be worse, mm-hmm. and that's good in terms of the politics and funding. I mean, there the issues are huge.
Yeah.
And so going back to how we opened this conversation, I wouldn't even make claims. I'm supposed to be knowledgeable about this. That's why I'm sitting here. That's why I do my job. And so for anybody listening, I apologize that I'm not going to be able to, with any confidence, enlighten us as to, in many cases, what's going to happen with federal funding. I mean, just prior to coming here, I was on the phone with had a meeting with a community college president from Northern Illinois. We were talking about a project that had been funded, and I said, yeah, it was funded. It was funded, passed by Congress, signed into law by President Biden. The money has all been allocated. There should be no question. At the same time, I'm not going to give you a 100% guarantee that what we're two semesters into is going to see its way till the end of this project. I can't guarantee anything even though, yeah, this should be 100% safe. And so I think that's a good description of where we're at. I think we know that CTE funding, career and technical education funding, that's pretty safe. Now, that has been transferred from the Department of Education to the Department of Labor.
Yeah.
And so does it get implemented as smoothly in the same ways? Well, that's all in process right now. Other things like the National School Lunch Program, which feeds kids across Illinois breakfast and lunch in many cases. I don't know. I don't know what my prediction is. I'm surprised what's happening with special education surprises me. Whether you're in a blue congressional district or a red congressional district, there are school district administrators saying, we need our funding for special education, and we're looking at the federal government going hard after both the structure and the dollars related to special education right now. And I don't know where we'll be sitting on that come the start of the school year in August.
And I certainly will not be asking you to make any predictions on that. Like, again, it's hard enough to predict the future anytime, let alone right now. So I think that instead of that, we will try to give people as best as we can a perspective of where things are at right now and what's happened over the past year. And you mentioned specifically with the U.S. Department of Education, right? That was another topic that we talked about last year. And obviously that was a huge thing, you know, coming out of the election. It was a priority for the administration to, you know, dismantle, to just get rid of the Department of Education. And so, again, before we actually talk about the specifics of where things are at with that now, I do want to take a second for people who are listening who, again, don't feel like they have a good understanding of what exactly the Department of Education is and does. And so I want to give it to the perspective, since you've been a school administration, you've worked in education for 30 years. What are the primary ways, and again, I know there are a lot of them, but what are some of the biggest ways in which schools regularly are interacting with the Department of Education?
Yeah, so let's start at the post-secondary level, actually. So there, the Department of Ed has a lot of impact on, first of all, managing financial aid. So that's really critical for a large percentage of students at universities across the country who rely on that and rely on those processes kind of happening with routine consistency, if you will.
Yeah.
And then other grants and projects like that. And again, in the university world, those are critical. Like that's not what funds the day-to-day, but it's what funds research, for example. So lots of research money that flows through the U.S. Department of Ed and its sub-departments. So all that starts to get thrown into question if it's not functioning the way it always has. Then on the K-12 side, it tends to be around specific programs. And so special education, multilingual education, those are two. Title I, which is funding to support students with large percentage schools, excuse me, with large percentage of low income students.
Massive program. We're talking about like $19 billion.
Massive program. And the multilingual is Title III. Title II is professional development. Like there's these title programs that through legislation, Congress has said, we think this is a good use of federal dollars to support state and local dollars. And then what happens is as a school district, you don't have to, or as a state even, at the state level, you can say, we're not going to take that money. And then you don't have to play by those rules unless it's related to civil rights law. And that's the other piece. The U.S. Department of Ed
has civil rights.
Exactly right. The Office for Civil Rights. So if there's a complaint that, you know, someone's going to say locally, we think this needs to be investigated, we think this violates civil rights law, then it's the U.S. Department of Ed who can come in and do that. And so in Illinois, we continue to fund our schools heavily with a mix of local property taxes and then state funding. And depending on your level of local property taxes, that is what will determine how much state funding you're getting. So school districts with very valuable property locally, which is not actually, people oftentimes think of like, oh, big homes, they have a lot of money. It's industry is worth a lot more than big homes. So like your wealthiest district per student is going to be full of industry and has very few homes, and active industry, not empty, right? So, but that mix means that really the federal funding is coming in to do those specific things.
And when you look at that whole pie of how much, you know, how schools are funded, the amount of that comes from the federal government, the amount of that is federal funding is usually a very small. It's usually single-digit percentages.
In many districts, though, it gets large in our larger districts with high needs. So it is kind of interesting, especially like in, you know, if we look across northern Illinois from Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River, we'll see all kinds of combinations in that pie graph.
You can get up into the, like, almost the low 20s.
Correct.
Too, right?
You could definitely get into the 20s. But in most places, we're talking anywhere from as low as 1% to 2% to that 5% to 8% range, very common. So
So when we look at broadly with the Department of Education, it does still exist. It is still there. Over the past year, kind of the effort of the administration has been to kind of break it up in terms of layoffs for various departments, in terms of, you mentioned this, moving various things to different departments. The president or the executive on their own cannot legally get rid of the Department of Education. And, you know, lawmakers right now say that what they're doing, trying to, you know, chop away at it right now is also illegal. So we'll see where that goes. But so we've outlined what the main roles and responsibilities are for the Department of Education. Just over this past year, how dramatically have things changed? When we talk about the layoffs, when we talk about, you know, moving to different departments, but the Department of Education as it existed a year ago before Trump's second inauguration and where we stand now, is it slightly different, do you feel like? Is it a vastly, vastly different operation?
So I think, first of all, there's different answers for different levels of education.
Right.
And I'll come back to that in 1 second. The other thing is there's, in general, there's a little bit of a lag with the impact of, and this is even if it's functioning perfectly, with what's happening with the federal government, and then when school districts or community colleges or universities feel that impact, it's oftentimes the following year, for better or worse. So, like, if a new Congress and president came in and the economy's humming, they're like, we want to fund federal innovation grants to schools. I'm making something up here. But schools wouldn't see that money till the next budget cycle.
Right.
So with all that said, I think some of the most immediate, though, like regular, like teachers aren't seeing this, is some of those layoffs have significantly affected data collection initiatives, research initiatives, testing initiatives, and so those with immediate effect.
Right. And I think even I have this as a note for later on, we're getting specifics about how particular programs are affected, but layoffs within particular programs, like, for example, the Office for Civil Rights, right? When there's direct layoffs there, that I feel like that impact is probably more immediate there.
It could be.
It could be. Okay.
Yeah, because what could happen there is, like, for example, an ongoing investigation could now just languish.
Right.
So it's not like that an investigation no longer exists. It's no one. There's no one there to work on it. There was a point in time when the ERIC database of research, anybody can go look up things on the ERIC research database supported by the federal government, it was going to come down completely, which, like, any post-secondary undergrad graduate student, like, relies on that if they're studying education or, frankly, a number of other social sciences. And so it exists now, but just the other day I heard a statistic from a librarian that they're at about 40% of what they were at in terms of getting new articles up. So if someone's studying AI research in education, those are new articles. Like, you're not going back to, I mean, there are articles from the 1990s on it, but that's not as relevant to today's generative AI models that we all know about and hear about. That means not as many of those articles are going up, and they're not going up as quickly as possible. And so being able to access that would have a real impact on you. Now, in terms of some of this other stuff, funding flowed for this year, and there's still questions about funding for next year on other programs that in many cases remain to be seen. Again, I think historically, if stuff was passed in a budget, the law would say, and signed into law by the president, well, that money's going to come through. The playbook that we've seen in this last year is there may be an executive order to stop the spending of that money and then a series of court cases to determine if that money should come through. Well, if I'm at a state agency level, like the Illinois State Board of Education, or at a school district level, like name your local school district in Illinois, and that money's not coming through, how am I paying the teacher or the school psychologist that's supposed to be paid out of that money. So even if the case gets decided in our favor in 18 to 24 months, what has happened in the interim? I don't have the answers there. I mean, right now, districts are trying to figure out how they can keep things flowing. But there's not been an increase in state funding outside the small, $300 million doesn't sound small, but the small increases in evidence-based funding. Everything else has had to be held flat because there's a ripple effect from other federal dollars not coming into the state and the state trying to plug those gaps, if you will.
Before we move on to the issues for this year, let's go try to get a little bit deeper into the specific programs maybe that we've mentioned, just a few of them, right? When we're talking about federal funding, and you've mentioned it that so often over the past year. This has been my experience as a reporter, too, where huge news breaks where the federal government is freezing $240 million worth of Title II funding for the state of Illinois schools. This is 3 weeks before the school year is supposed to start. What are we even going to do? And there's a part of my head, Jason, that's like, okay, I'm going to write this story now, and then 2 hours later, the news is going to change, and it's going to get released. It's going to get challenged in court. And so that has been the story for so many things this year, whether it be grants or federal programs. And you just saw it the other day where there was, again, I think $1 billion worth of funding for Illinois child care programs, like the child care assistance program in Illinois, that, again, was announced. Everyone was like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And then 2 days later, it was challenged in court, and there was, you know, an injunction or whatever it might be. It could be, like you said, months and months later where a school-based mental health grant is canceled, and then we find out months later that they're not allowed to cancel it. It's just been my entire year, Jason, you're getting an insight into. It's just been like, and again, I'm sure it's similar at the school level too, right? Like, this huge thing has happened, but is the same, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow?
Yeah, so that's exactly how, I mean, right, those injunctions from judges, I mean,
yeah,
judges have had a huge impact. I mean, oftentimes a judge may have an impact on an individual school district in a particular lawsuit, but the way judges have had wide-ranging impact without it being like a Supreme Court case, this might be unprecedented in school law in U.S. history. Like, certainly there are plenty of precedents, Brown v. the Board of Education, where judges have had a huge, wide-ranging impact on school districts across the country. But that hasn't been at this level that judges have been making these decisions, oftentimes a single judge having to make a decision. So we are in uncharted territory. And again, school districts are trying to keep going what they can keep going. But it is complicated.
And it makes it difficult to plan for the future, right?
It makes it very difficult. And so school districts are mostly pretty good at planning conservatively, financially.
Especially in this state, people have been through times where funding at the state level was inconsistent or unknown for the next year.
Yep, exactly.
Just to outline a few of these programs, we're going to play a game I'm going to call, I heard a headline about this, whatever happened at that. So I mentioned this one already in our conversation, which was a title funding. That was something that over the last, you know, summer, there was this huge, hey, hundreds of millions dollar funding freeze. What's going to go on with that? And then that got, I guess the freeze was thawed out. The money was released. Where are we at with that, Jason? Is title funding flowing the way that it typically does?
Well, right now, title funding is mostly flowing. Again, we're at the point we're already planning for next school year. Given the mix of what's happening at the state level for a variety of reasons, in part because of what's happening at the federal level across all federal funding, not just education funding, and then what's happening at the federal level specific to education funding, it is making it very hard to come up with those assumptions and still without like making assumptions that mean, oh, we have to cut off 5% of our budget for next year, right? 80-ish% of our budget is people in school districts. And we're not buying 5% less Chromebooks. That doesn't get us anywhere. Like that seems like a lot of money, but it's really not in the scope of a school district budget.
I heard a headline about Head Start funding. Whatever happened with that? I can answer that one really quickly with as much as I can with some of the notes from, again, the past couple months and reporting we've done. Obviously, again, there's huge layoffs with those departments, the regional offices that were closed that, again, just make it difficult for local Head Start to communicate about grants or whatever else it might be with the federal government. There was a big issue where the federal government in these grant proposals were telling them, or you know, basically they were not allowed to use words like disability or any word that might be construed as a diversity-related mm-hmm. word. And then there was a recent, again, talk about the courts back over just like last week where they were like, a federal judge says, actually, you can't do that. And so I've had a couple stories over the last year talking to local Head Start people. And again, for them, it is the same experience where it is, oh my God, here's this huge headline, we're going to lose funding. Late January of last year, so really early on in the administration, there was huge news about funding cuts to Head Start where these local Head Start organizations were literally calling all of their employees and saying, you're getting laid off tomorrow, and then 3 hours later having to call them back and say, just kidding.
Right.
So it seems like that's kind of still where we're at with them now.
Well, and so let me take Head Start and say Head Start is one specific example of early childhood.
Yes.
But early childhood is this bigger umbrella, and it is extremely complicated.
Yeah.
All the different ways we deliver early childhood services to children and families across not only Illinois, but across the United States. And so now, if we take those two steps back from the Head Start specific thing that I think you just described very, very well, and say, let's instead refer to that as early childhood, which includes Head Start and includes lots of other funding streams too, some of which have specifically targeted for a long time things like students, children with identified disabilities. This program here is designed specifically for those children. And now we're going to say, no, it can't support those children. Well, that's what that program was designed to do. We've seen in the last couple of weeks, the whole early childhood conversation is obviously, it's gone to chaos as we record this here in late January. And Minnesota is obviously, our neighbors in Minnesota are at the center point of that conversation. And so, again, it makes it very hard to say what will happen next Monday or Tuesday to Head Start or to any other specific early childhood program. Because is there an understanding now of we have these different early childhood funding streams for these different early childhood purposes, or now have we kind of lost the plot of that? And it's like, well, early childhood. Early yeah. childhood is bad. Money's going places it shouldn't be. And in fact, of course, we know from educational research that early childhood is one of our biggest levers
yeah.
to pull to improve students' lifelong achievement. Even if we don't improve literacy and math instruction in schools and we keep doing things how we've always done them, students will have better outcomes if they've had exposure to good early childhood experiences. If we do good early childhood experiences and we keep improving things, then sky's the limit for kids, right?
Yeah. Oh, and I mentioned that $1 billion for Illinois childcare that was frozen last week. Of course, that was a direct response
Correct.
To the administration's allegations about things happening in Minnesota. And they're like, well, Illinois is a blue state. They cut it over there, too. And I think that was three different programs, two of which were specifically funding for programs like the Child Care Assistance Program in Illinois, too. So.
And so the complexity of this on the early childhood side is we do have early childhood programming. This varies from community to community of is it run by the school district? Is it run by a separate community-based organization?
Yeah.
But where in what we might call our kids program or whatever we've named it in our community, there could be three funding streams providing programming for three different classrooms that are right next to each other that publicly all have the same name because it's how we've branded it locally. And one could be like, that money's gone, and the other two are fine. Do you realize how much confusion and anxiety that will create for parents, for administrators?
Someone saw a headline about the Office for Civil Rights and cuts and layoffs, and actually similar to the conversation that we just had about Head Start, where layoffs and you know regional offices that get closed. And again, is that something that, as we stand right now, that office still exists? But again, how that actually impacts the way that those cases are able to be investigated in terms of staffing and whatever else, you know, that is probably the stuff that's most impacted, I would guess.
So I would guess that, too. This is an interesting one because this is not one where I've said to friends and colleagues, either in local school districts or in the state agencies, hey, have we seen cases that were really active kind of dry up or slow down?
Yeah.
And my guess is that's where we stand. I have questions in my head about then with, you know, remaining staff, is it, and staff, that is there a cherry picking of cases that I could see this happening? I don't know this. I have no evidence of this. I'm not accusing anybody in Washington, D.C. of this. It's a thing I wonder about. Will cases, depending on where they are and the specifics of a case, determine which cases continue to move forward at this point? Which to some degree has always been, that's the professional expertise of the Office of Civil Rights. That's what they had to do. So in some ways, that's not new. That's just part of the work. But in other ways, if selections are being made, maybe based on different criteria than we've used in the past, which again, I don't know if that's the case, but as I watch targeted things happen across areas of not only education, but other areas of policy, I could see that happening. I don't know that, though, and that's a really good question.
Yeah, and you do see the data tracking part of this change, where on their website, it would update every week about the new cases that were being investigated, and that has not been updated, I believe, since last January. And then the like recently closed cases, that has been updated, but much more sporadically than in the past. So that's just another point of this, that it makes it a little bit more difficult for the public to track, at least.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And again, that's kind of overlays with what I mentioned earlier with some of the hard research functions of parts of the Department of Education that went from 100 people to one or two people.
So the topics that we wanted to talk about for 2026, we really tried to kind of break it down from a national level to a state level and then some local issues. And I was really fascinated by the term that you wrote down on our document for national, which I think that we can start from just this phrase and then go off of everything that deals with, which is, you use the phrase chilling effects. And we can, you know, again, look at how that affects everything from attendance to speech to immigration, all that stuff. But why did you go with chilling effects?
Attendance has been getting better year on year since 22, let's say, is 2022, as we kind of came out of COVID. Well, now these actions of the federal government, whether it's, are we going to have money for buses for special education students who need that special bus route that picks them each up at their own home and has a bus with a wheelchair lift, for example? Or am I going to be worried about there being no parents at home because of immigration action? And so I'm not going to send my kid to school and we're all going to stay in the house. These things have a chilling effect on what school districts were trying to do to improve attendance. So while there's been no direct action from the federal government to say, we want to make attendance worse, I haven't heard anybody say, I haven't heard the Secretary of Education say that. So I'm not putting those words in her mouth. But these other actions have local school administrators, teachers are saying all over the place, these are making it harder to make attendance better. And so that's one example of that chilling effect of policy action X or Y.
Yeah. And with attendance, yeah, you heard that especially, again, in late January of last year when all the immigration crackdowns were really starting. You heard from a lot of, again, like particularly more heavily Latino school districts of people saying, yeah, we've got families who are just afraid to send their kids to school right now. And then, again, that was a year ago. Some things changed. Schools, of course, are trying their best to, let families know that school is a place to, you know, that you can send your kids. You do still hear it from people. Again, we're a year later. You definitely still hear from people in various different communities around Northern Illinois. Where we've been done reporting that is still an issue. That is still something that people hear.
So a related example of this is, we know there's been a lot of talk for many years now about the teacher shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And one aspect of the teacher shortage that we've worked on is not just that pipeline of new teachers coming into the profession, but teachers staying engaged in the profession. It's often referred to as retention.
Yeah.
We like to think about it as, even our goal would be bigger than retention, more engagement. Like, we want people continue growing throughout their career. Well, the opposite of all this is burnout, right? Burnout is what leads to poor retention. People are like, I can't do this anymore. Teachers have this year, for example, again, because of other actions, done things that are far outside the realm of teaching a novel or algebra to kids. They've gotten on school buses and walked kids to their door in communities where immigration action is taking place at the time. They've had to deal with the emotions of being pulled into school in the morning and the principal saying, you know, we've learned that so-and-so's parents are no longer living with them. We don't know if we're going to see them at school today. If they're here, please bring them down to the office or call the social worker so we can figure out what's going on with them. Are they safe? Where are they living? And that's let alone then getting them to learn that algebra. And teachers are people. They're humans. And they interact closely with these students and their families. And so that's let's just say there seems to be a lot of chitter-chatter that this isn't going to help the burnout situation. And these pressures are weighing very heavily on people. And so we've seen schools not be immune from having a presence. And so, again, I don't want to overhype on the immigration actions, but I will say for many school districts, increasingly around the state of Illinois, not just in the city of Chicago, let me be exceedingly clear about that, these are weighing heavily. And again, it's having a chilling effect. Makes it real hard for me to plan a new instructional unit that's super innovative and creative when, like, I'm this drained emotionally just from trying to get through the day keeping kids safe.
Yeah, and even just give, like, one specific example on that for people to kind of understand what this could look like. Again, just based on my reporting and stories that I've done over the last year, where this summer I talked with a family in Rockford, right? And they've got one kid who is in middle school and one kid who just graduated high school and was starting college this fall, right? And, you know, they're a Latino family. Then on one specific day, they hear about how there's increased immigration action happening in their neighborhood. The middle school kid is supposed to have soccer practice. Now feels like he can't go to soccer practice. Again, all the kind of social and school stuff that the components into that. The older daughter who's just starting college is supposed to have a meeting at the local community college to meet with their advisor and set up classes. They can't go to that. So how does that impact their ability to sign up for classes and to attend college? And that's, you know, again, just like one day, one family, all of these things of how, you know, that impacts attendance in various different ways. It can also be a chilling effect when it comes to speech is another thing that we mentioned. And I think about that especially through the higher ed lens of, like, international students, right? Like, even here at Northern Illinois University, I think it was in April, sometime last spring, there was an announcement where there was across the country tons of visas that the administration was canceled. And there was a handful at NIU, and I remember talking with a group of international students at that time, and again, talk about the speech part of this. They wanted to be anonymous because any criticism they might have about the administration's action, they felt like could get their visa revoked. And so they're not going to want to speak about certain things. They're not going to want to post on social media about certain things. I mean, there were even people who had heard rumors that some other international student friends of theirs, maybe at different colleges, got pulled over for a speeding ticket. And so having that on their record was then used as a pretense for their visa getting canceled. So again, speech, I think about that particularly when it comes to higher ed. And that even you can extend that into, you know, like pro-Palestine protests over the past couple of years in the U.S. too.
Yeah, well, and again, the other thing to think about on that, and your visa example is a good example, but it's in the classroom. And the courts historically in the U.S. have given wide latitude to not want to get too judgy on what is and isn't okay in the classroom. There's a number of Supreme Court cases that have famously said, well, that's the domain of the teacher. Now, one of the principles is that as students get older, their age and the nature of a topic kind of defines what's appropriate, and then where free speech comes in. And that's both for the instructor, the teacher, the faculty member, as well as for the students themselves. And so it exists kind of along this continuum, right? From upper elementary school through middle school and high school. What you can say with 11th and 12th graders probably different than with 9th graders, or not even what you can say, but how you're handling the topic in class. And then when we move into post-secondary, wide latitude for that. And I think there's a strong argument to be made. How do we really address complex issues in the classroom, whether they're complex science issues or complex social science issues, or, and I know most of us don't think this way about mathematics, but like if we're at the cutting edge of mathematics, we can have a real strong argument about the math theory, right? With that said, this chilling effect comes into play there. And I think that's true for both students and teachers. Again, we're hearing things about this. I don't know of any research that's been done on this. Even right there, this is now a hard topic to research. How do you go survey people in a way that protects your survey respondents, as you're required to do in your research process, in asking them these questions? I'm sure people are trying it and probably doing a great job with it, but it's more complicated now. And that all comes from this chilling effect concept.
When we zoom in a little bit closer on the state level, one of the issues that you had brought up was enrollment. This has been something that has been on my mind a lot lately, so I'm glad that you brought it up. What were you thinking about?
So first of all, let me say, Peter, I'm a weird guy.
Okay.
So I love sports.
Yeah.
I like to watch sports on the TV in the living room. The other thing I like to watch on the TV in the living room is school board meetings on YouTube.
Yes.
So, and for me, it's a little bit like a sporting event. I don't mean to say it's unimportant. Like, yeah, I'd like the Bears to win and keep moving forward, but really the outcome doesn't have a direct impact on my life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know these are much more serious than that, but I watch them very engaged. And again, I know it's strange to be watching them in the first place. And
well, I mean, you're maybe talking to the wrong person.
Well, that's true.
Also watching
and,
a lot of
and
it.
I'll yell at the screen. Again, like a sporting event. And one of the things I have found myself yelling at the screen for multiple school districts over the first 4 or 5 months of this school year, so as we concluded 2025 and are running into 2026, is on this topic of declining enrollments. A number of times I've watched school boards be surprised about their enrollment, and there's been a consistent reaction. We need to do something to get more kids to come to school here. And I kind of love that. Like, I love that sense of ownership.
Like sports. We need to recruit some kids in here.
Exactly. That's exactly.
The NIL
and
dollars focused
and
on
we
that.
Want, we want our programs to be so great that people want to come here. So, like, I'm 100% on board with where the school board members are when they say that. The issue is, and again, this speaks to, this is not me saying, oh, school board members don't understand. I think it's caught a lot of administrators by surprise. I think teachers haven't necessarily been aware of it until relatively recently. But this is a demographic issue we've seen coming. Now, certainly in a place like Illinois, and particularly in Northern Illinois, where we have large immigrant communities, the immigration stuff actually has an impact here,
yeah,
too, right? I had a meeting with one superintendent the other day who said they build out 3 extra sections in their high schools because they typically will have about 75 new English learners enroll at the high school level each year, and then they've got those spaces. And this year, they had 8, and they were all from one place in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And none from anywhere south of the United States, for example, which historically would have been the large majority of those 75 they would have gotten. And so it's like, whoa, okay, our declining enrollments, we knew were coming because of birth rates.
Yes.
And universities and community colleges have been talking about it for years. They've been talking about the quote-unquote enrollment cliff that we are now hitting. So it is wild. I mean, a school district I spent a lot of time in was always about 7,000 students, and now they're under 6. And so you look at the report card and you see that 5 at the beginning. It's like, whoa, that's a lot different,
yeah,
than what it was. And that happened in 10 years, and it's going to keep happening, we think, based on demographics. Now, that's got some knock-on effects financially.
Yeah.
And then what we can offer.
Really quick before we get into that, I want to give people a little more context about what that looks like statewide.
Please.
For people.
Yeah.
That so since just 2018, enrollment statewide, K through 12 schools, is down like 7.5%. But if you think about it like this, if you think about 2025 compared to 2010, so some 15 years ago, there are 200,000 fewer students in Illinois public schools now than there were in 2010, which is, again,
That's going to look very different depending on the district that you're in, right? There are even districts that are growing, right? When we think about this from a large-scale perspective, enrollment is down and has been going down for some time.
Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember, though, so when we talk about decreasing enrollments, and this is where it gets really tricky. If we have 10 schools in our school district, let's say we have 10 elementary schools, and we have 10% fewer students, we should close one school. Like, the math seems to work out. The problem is students are not evenly distributed, not only across schools, but across grade levels within those schools. This is why you'll hear administrators in a multi-school district oftentimes come back to the community with a proposal for grade level centers. So we're going to put all K-2 kids here, 3-5 there, yep, and 6-8 there. And because if I now have 10 third grade classrooms and I see a decrease of 24 students in third grade, I will have one less teacher next year. If I have all those third grade classrooms spread across 10 buildings, I'm going to have a couple kids in this building, 4 kids in this building. It's not going to be enough to like change my teacher numbers. And again, that even assumes that they're relatively evenly distributed, which is not how movement happens in neighborhoods. We see neighborhoods. I think about the neighborhood I live in. It's about half repopulated with young children and school-age children, right? And there's probably another 25% of homes that will turn over here in the next couple of years that probably would have already turned over if home prices and mortgage rates didn't look like they do, yeah. To be perfectly honest, yeah. Right? You've retired, you're on a fixed income, you're going to give up your 3% mortgage?
No.
And so they're hanging on to that home. So there's a lot of factors that go into what those patterns look like related to enrollment. And it's so much more complicated, even in a small district, than just, here's our number of students, so we should do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And again, whether you have fewer students or not, you still need to be able to meet their needs in the best way possible, too. Right? Like, I think about, there's an interesting thing that's happened, too, which is that I mentioned that there are 200,000 fewer students than there were in 2010. In that same time, there are also 5,000 more teachers teaching. And you could say, oh, that doesn't, that somehow doesn't make sense. Like, how does that happen? I'm sure you could probably make an argument. Maybe we didn't have enough teachers back then, so maybe it does. You know what I mean? Like, it's not as straightforward as those numbers seem, but also it does raise questions about where we're, like, we know that this is going to be difficult, and we know just based on birth rates that this is not a problem that's going away anytime soon, but the solutions to those things, like you've been talking about, are not straightforward at all, whether you're in a large school or a small one.
Yeah, so we have definitely expanded, in general, the types of teachers doing different things that are having an impact on student learning. So it is, you've just described it. It's very complicated. And the only way you can understand it is literally by going district by district, and in some cases, school by school, to say, who are these people? What are they doing? What's the impact they're having? Then, if you're in a situation where you're like, oh, we're going to have to make some cuts, again, how you make those cuts, I mean, I have strong feelings based on research about effective schools. So my feelings didn't come out of thin air. They came out of research from the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and 2010s that consistently has said we need to involve people in the community in making those decisions. And that is both a science, what data are we looking at, and an art. How do we lead people through a painful process? And again, sometimes we can offset that. Oh, we've got 3 teachers retiring this year. Now, again, it's not always as easy as we're just not replacing those teachers. That is our only teacher teaching 2 dual credit science classes. We have to find someone who can do that if we want to keep offering those. Yeah.
And it's a complicated math problem, but it's also not just, like you said, it's a science and art, right? Like, it's a complicated math problem, yes, but it's also not just a math problem in terms of schools are really important places to people.
Yeah.
And so the prospect of, again, not only just the prospect of someone losing their job, which of course is awful and is emotional, but the idea of closing a school is just very difficult.
100%.
It means a lot to families and communities going back generations in some cases. You know, I think about, I started covering education in, it would have been 2019, in that spring. Mm-hmm. And that right at that time, there was a small school district here in Northern Illinois that, they, you know, there was a referenda. They voted to deactivate their high school, and K through 12 joined a different district. And I remember at that time, just again, even then, thinking about the trends with enrollment, being like, this is probably something that's going to start happening more and more. And it really hasn't.
No.
And I've been surprised about that. And again, that's dealing with a small rural school versus maybe a larger, like, suburban unit school district. But, you know, there's been some other referenda to, you know, consolidate smaller districts or things like that. I've seen them get voted down, at least in our area. But I've been surprised that that hasn't happened more. And because, again, it is difficult to be like, this high school that students went to for 100 years is no longer going to exist. That sucks. That's hard. I wonder if maybe with the trends, we're getting to a point where maybe it's going to be more and more difficult to kind of keep going the way that we're going.
Yeah, I think you've brought up some really important things. Number one, again, the art of how we move people through these processes. And I've watched districts that are, like, right now in real time in Northern Illinois, really struggling through stuff as a community. And from what I can tell from the outside, there have been good processes that have involved. Now, everybody doesn't feel like this there because, again, the topics are difficult. But teachers and parents and, in some cases, kids have been involved. And I'm a big proponent that we should include students on this. I mean, I've seen boundary changes. And one of the things I've learned about boundary changes in my experience is, yep, they're very traumatic. But, B, when we provide kids some cool entry opportunities, the kids tend to do great. Now, I know people are afraid, what if they don't? So I understand that fear. I mean, as a parent, I understand that fear.
You're at a public meeting and this, like, fourth grader is like, please don't close my school.
And that's like, the other thing. We've seen a lot of that. And in one of the districts I'm thinking of right now, there have been lots of kids coming up, which awesome. That's awesome. We need to be doing that.
Right, because on one hand, that's like, we're starting from a great point there, which is that everyone cares about this school.
That's exactly right. And that we're giving kids these opportunities to not only find their own voice, but have it be heard by
others. If
people
were like, thank God they're closing the school, then you're in a much deeper problem.
That is exactly true. And again, we do have to do those. And even when we do all those best practices, these processes will not be easy. And when you talk about, like, the deactivation of the high school, I was the one who was lucky enough to study that. And twice, the first year of the new scenario and then the third year of the new scenario.
We had a conversation about it was pawpaw. Exactly, it's something that's a secret. I did a story about it 6 years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
And it worked out great. Like, again, from my study, so not every single parent was happy and there were things to work on, but both districts involved were hyper committed to continuing to improve those things. And what we saw was what a shift in outcomes students had by then going to Indian Creek. They had more dual credit opportunities. They had more CTE opportunities. They had more co-curricular opportunities. And again, I find both of those schools and school districts and communities to be very special to me from being lucky enough to be involved in working with them. And so, yeah, your question, is that a model? Like, there, they deactivated the high school. They kept the K-8. Maybe that's cool. Maybe creative
about what to do with the rest of the building and things
and
like that. Yeah.
I just had a conversation yesterday where I said, I blew some people's socks off and I said, you know, I wonder if school districts are going to have to share some teachers, which already gets done through, like, co-ops and some other models. And there's examples of this happening. But again, as we look at not only based on student numbers, but also kind of niche-specific requirements that we might have. We're faced with these kind of challenges, this is an optimistic, positive thing. I am filled with optimism that we have the right people who want to do good work for kids and that it will force us to innovate in some new ways that might be really great, not only for students, but for educators and communities as well. And I think that's also true, let me say this, at the post-secondary level, where it really is causing people at both community colleges and universities to say, What are we doing? What's the most important things that we do? What's the best way to do those? How do we meet the needs of our communities and our students? And particularly for public institutions like our community colleges and public universities, it really puts that, what's our mission here? What's our public mission? And then how do we attack that? And so I do think while these are challenging times, there are also real opportunities for innovation that can lead to breakthroughs that maybe we haven't gotten through before. And that may sound a little Pollyanna-ish, and maybe it is. There's a lot of hard work that goes into that, but I don't know. It makes it a lot easier to get up in the morning if we start with, hey, how can we turn this into something really positive?
Jason, one thing I appreciate about you is that you seem to always bring at least one sports-related thing into our conversations here. You did have the IHSA state football playoff expansion on our list here. Why?
Well, so you just said it a minute ago. We have a high school that's 100 years old, and we're going to close it. Like, high schools are important in communities, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I had a superintendent say to me, I think it was last week, when your football team has a good fall, it changes the nature of the school year.
Isn't that wild?
It is totally wild. And that's not to say that the musical is unimportant or that cross country in the fall is unimportant. All of those things, I'm lucky enough to have grown up thinking all of those things were important and getting to experience those things. I feel very lucky about that. At the same time, it is true, and partially it's because in many communities, like football or basketball, are the biggest shared experiences. Yeah. I would love to see speech team be just as big a shared experience at some point in my career here, too. That's that shared experience.
So many of us have that experience of going to a football game on a Friday night, which people go to even if they could not care less about what's happening
on the
field.
That's exactly. And that's why, and so this is important for communities. I want to acknowledge that. And that's why I put it on the list. Because and you know, IHSA is, and same thing with IESA, which does middle level state competitions, again, not just in sports, but in other areas too. It's this balance of student opportunity with competition. And how do we balance those things and both not water down the competition, but increase really meaningful opportunities for as many students as possible. So this in IHSA land, the bylaws, people make recommendations, and then they get voted on by the whole community. And so the playoffs have been expanded for next year. So there will still be eight classes, 1A through 8A, based on school size. But instead of having 32 teams make the playoffs in each class, there will now be 48 teams making the playoffs in each class. So that's dozens more schools. That's over 100 more schools that will now get to experience that playoff experience. And so if they've got a marching band, if they've got cheerleaders, that's another game for them. But I think it's really important because what it does speak to is these other issues. I mean, this relates to finances. Like, football is, in many cases, our most expensive sport. It's got a lot of kids, needs, compared to soccer, like, equipment looks entirely different in terms of costs for football than it does for soccer, for example. Using that just as one example, even refs, like, you know, we have three refs on a soccer field. I don't even know how many refs are on a high school football field. Is it five?
Yeah,
is
I
it,
think about that.
I think it's five.
In that area, yeah.
But it's, yeah, in that neighborhood. I should know that. But anyways, with that said, that costs more money. And so you're looking at all of these things, and it's really, really interesting to think about.
Well, it's interesting to think about, like, from the college perspective too, right? Like, obviously, like, football is the most expensive, but it also, at least for, again, we're talking about maybe elite colleges, it also brings in the most money and helps make sure that we can pay for equipment and other things in other sports that
Correct.
Maybe don't get enough attention. I don't know if that's necessarily the same story at the high school level. It may be.
Yeah, I couldn't speak to. That's interesting. I think there could be communities where that's true. I think in Illinois, that may be less true than in some other states.
Sure.
And that's okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting move. Again, I'm a proponent of more kids getting more opportunities. So, and we do have IHSA state football playoffs is different than other sports. Where other sports, you gain entry You know you're going to have that one regional game or that regional meet or whatever to start your postseason, and that might be the end of your postseason. So it does make football a little bit more like other sports in a way that, that gives more students more opportunities. And so I think it's just interesting in a world of declining enrollments and flat funding. I mean, you could do your movie voice there.
Yeah.
In a world of declining enrollments and flat funding, we're expanding state football playoffs. And I think that's good, actually. And again, that's not me being like, oh, sports are more important than academics or music. None of that is true. I just think giving kids opportunities is really great. And again, I don't know on the dollars and cents side, like what this actually costs us and is that a problem or not. I don't have an insight into that. That's actually an interesting question for someone to look into.
We have two more topics I want to talk about. One of them, I think, piggybacks really nicely off our conversation about enrollment, which is that I wanted to ask you about something I know that you're passionate about, too, which is career and technical education. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how I did a story in the fall about this new, brand new, huge CTE center at Waubonsie Community College right next to us. And over the course of research that, I realized that like there's a handful, like at least a half dozen or so community colleges in Illinois that are all either have just recently built or in the process of building out big CTE centers. And that's something that they communicated to me a lot about, like, hey, in a world within declining enrollment, here is one of the few places that we feel like is maybe a growth opportunity for us. And I know this is something that you have done just a lot of work on, too, over the last couple of years.
When we think about career and technical education, I think, first of all, the first thing we have to start with, and this is true whether we're talking about middle school or high school or post-secondary, is for many of us, and certainly for myself, in our modern world, it's not a you're either doing college prep or career and technical education. I believe, and I think many people believe, all kids need both of those things. Mm-hmm. If you go straight into a trade, that's awesome, that's lucrative, we need people in those careers, those are, would in many cases fall under the umbrella of high wage, high demand jobs right now. You will need to continue to learn new things, most likely throughout your career, and some of that will be in a kind of a more traditional learning setting, whether it's online by yourself or whether it's in a classroom setting. So you need to have the reading, writing, and math skills, the critical thinking skills to be able to be successful in that post-secondary space, regardless of path.
Also just helps to be a well-rounded person,
it,
right?
It does. It, well, and again, an educated citizen, right? As a consumer of information and then as a voter, you having those skills helps you with all of that.
Yeah.
At the same time, the bachelor's degree is critical for certain things. It's not critical for everything. Yeah. And
even some of these CTE things, right? Like are still bachelor's degree programs.
Well, so that, and
too,
that's
right?
The other thing I was going to say. So
if you're in an automotive program, a lot of times you go to a community college for that, then you transfer and finish up at a four-year school.
Well, and I quote a superintendent, I'm going to name her here for superintendent I've named on this as I've referred to them. But her name's Jennifer Kelsall and she's the superintendent at Ridgewood High School, which is right next to O'Hare. And it's a one-school high school district, and Jen has a quote where she says, and not quoting her exactly, but paraphrasing, every student needs a career plan. And that's the whole sentence. Like there's nothing about college in that sentence. But if we start with every student needs a career plan, and then we figure out what do you need to do in high school and then post-secondary to accomplish that career plan, one of the things we avoid is a student who goes and gets an accounting degree and then discovers 6 months into this awesome job in downtown Chicago that they hate accounting and they wish they hadn't done that. We also avoid the situation where a student goes and gets a four-year bachelor's degree, is very in debt, and didn't need a degree for that career path at all. Or needed a two-year degree for that career path or something else. And so it's really well thought out. The other thing we have to remember is when students are learning these skills in these career experiences, whether it's in the classroom or in the workplace, those are skills that transfer across careers, number one, and again, into being good neighbors, into being good community members, into people who can show up at a park district board meeting and say, here's what I think. So with all that said, this doubling down by community colleges on CTE. We've gotten a lot of recognition for it. I only saw it in passing yesterday, just yesterday as we have this, the governor's office put out a thing that I did not click on. I didn't have time, and now I'm going to half give an answer here, but about our growth with regards to career pathways work and work-based learning work across the state. And that has to be happening at the school district level, at the community college level, and the community college, both for traditional students who come straight out of high school and go there, as well as for returning students. Community colleges have always been a great resource. There's always been this fun thing that community colleges have looked at that regular people haven't known. How many students do we have with bachelor's degrees who are here learning something new, whether that's one class or a certificate or some other program of study? These spaces are really fantastic opportunities, and particularly if they're tailored to the local needs, the local economic needs, the local workforce needs, and they're doing that. Our CTE infrastructure in Illinois has started to get really good. Not started, has always been good, but has particularly sharpened its pencil, I think, over the last 10 years with regards to those advisory councils, working with employers. One thing I will note is the last 2 years in the state's budget were the first two increases in CTE funding in a long time. And in the ISBE proposal that was published as part of this week's ISBE board meeting, there was another increase to CTE funding. So in a world where funding is flat, we are seeing at the ISBE level, and then so far for the last 2 years, we'll see what happens this spring in the General Assembly and the Governor's Office, that has been supported. And that needs to be supported. The other factor with CTE is we have a lot of what are called consumables there, right? Like if I'm going to weld stuff, sometimes I weld this stuff and I'm making a real thing and it's going out the door. I need more welding materials and metal. I have more machines that need maintenance in those spaces. There are services and consumables that just cost more money and costs are going up on those things. So if we want to really support CTE at all levels, we got to be prepared to spend a little. And in Illinois, we're doing that. And I think the outcomes are there. And again, there's a little lag, but I think in the next 3 to 5 years, we're already seeing big companies move into Illinois. And I know that hasn't always been the narrative and still isn't the common narrative, but the data shows that that's what's happening. And I think that will keep happening. And I hope that's a rising tide that raises all ships.
Now, the last one we have on here, I want to finish this off. We've talked about so much about uncertainty, about stress, about things being more difficult than they ever have been. So I want to end us on a slightly optimistic note here, Jason. And so you actually recently celebrated an anniversary of how long you've been in education. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so as we record this, it's a couple days from now. As this hits the airwaves, it'll be pretty close. It'll be the 30th anniversary of when I started working as a paid teacher. It was mid-year. I had graduated in the middle of the year, and I felt so lucky to fall into a position in a first-year middle school, a brand-new school. The most amazing teachers, principal, district office staff. Nothing else in my career would have been possible without that, because I saw things that looked so different from how, and this is where I'd gone to school in this district. These were like my teachers. I didn't want to call them by their first name. You've talked about that with people on the air before.
Yeah.
But they were doing things so much differently. And while middle school seemed a long time ago, I was 21 years old. It was like 8 years ago. It was, you know, 7.5 years ago. I was an eighth grader. And it was wildly different. And I look at the challenges we faced then. I mean, I had kids in gangs in year one in 1996. But in the challenges we face today, which are much greater. And in this current role, I've had the real gift of getting to build a network of colleagues, being in and out of schools and community colleges across the state of Illinois. And what I see, and I want other educators to know they're not alone with this, and I want the public to know this is where their tax dollars are going. Not everyone, but boy, people care about their jobs. People care about kids. They want to do good things. And even with everything going on, so like as you say, what cuts through the noise, people are trying to do better for individual kids and families that are in front of them every day. And It's the most extraordinary thing in the world. And I think in general, we are continuing to do better and better. And we need to tell our story better, but like, who's got time? And even as more districts have communications people than ever before, they're usually a shop of one. And as will happen with jobs, they fill their time very quickly. So that's my thing is there are great people doing great work. I'm particularly lucky to have gotten to meet and know them all over. And thank you for asking this. It's going to be a good year regardless. The kids are amazing. And we can meet them halfway. It'll be good.
I think that's the best place to end us off then.
That was our annual Top Education Issues of the Year podcast with Jason Klein. He is the Senior Director of Learning Partnerships at Northern Illinois University. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please continue to send your story ideas so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing this podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it with a friend. It's the best way to help us out so we can be even better. Thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. I've been your host, Peter Mudlin. This is Teacher's Lounge.